Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long could you go without buying anything but whole food and medicine? Think about it. Could you make it a week? A month? When would you start missing paper towels and Q-tips and wine and new socks? How about movie and concert tickets, restaurant dinners with friends? As journalist Judith Levine and her partner discovered, throughout the entire year of 2004, checking out of the checkout line is both rewarding and maddening for a modern American couple, and in surprising ways. Her book about the experience is just out in paperback. It's called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. We're delighted to have Judith Levine here to talk about the experience. Judith, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You write something in the book that I think is just beautiful, and that is, capitalism gives us everything except what is free. Can you talk about that idea a little bit?
That's right. We're very used to satisfying many, many desires, many legitimate desires for what is beautiful, what is satisfying, what is stimulating, what is exciting by buying things. And yet, those intangibles such as a sense of belonging to your community or feeling secure or knowing that you have power, let's say, you know, to change things, those things are not bought with money, and they are not only not given us by capitalism, but you could say in some ways are denied us in this consumer society.
Let's talk about the genesis of the idea for you. It was the end of 2003. You had spent like $1,000 on Christmas shopping, and we should
point
out you're not. Yeah, exactly. So, what made you say enough is enough?
Well, as I say in the book, I was walking across New York City in a slushy puddle. I dropped a bag. All my stuff started to fall out of the bag, and I looked around me at all the rest of the bags, and in the bags were all sorts of stuff that I knew we're probably going to end up in a landfill maybe 6 months down the road. And I started to think, you know, what's my relationship to all of this buying and giving and taking and throwing away? Maybe if I just got off the wheel for a little while, I would start to understand, you know, my emotional reaction to consumption, because it is really an emotional behavior, and then try to make some bigger connections between me and us and the way we behave and this very big global problem of buying and throwing away too much.
And you didn't really define yourself as a big shopper before.
You know, I wasn't the kind of person who would go off on a Saturday afternoon to the mall just for fun. I think of myself as a pretty parsimonious person, or just not a very greedy person, you know, not a person who's very much focused on material things. And yet when I stopped buying things and experiences and services, I recognized a large hole in my life.
How enthusiastic was Paul, your partner, at the get-go?
My partner, Paul, is a guy from a pretty poor family in Vermont. He knows how to do everything. He recycles, reuses, uses it up, you know, and has been doing so probably for three generations of his family. So he was super enthusiastic about it. And he was also a great Confederate because he can fix everything.
And from the very beginning, you had to figure out just what buying nothing would actually mean to you both. Can you talk about some of the rules you created?
Well, what we thought was we would buy just necessities. So what were necessities? We were going to buy basic grocery items, but no prepared foods of any kind, no cookies in a box, no pizza from the corner, not even a coffee from Starbucks. We would buy medicine if we needed it, and that included insulin for our diabetic cat, which some people consider to be a luxury to begin with, but we are rather attached to him. We kept our internet access because both of us work from home, but at the time we had dial-up and we didn't upgrade it. And what we would not buy would be any books or CDs or clothing or gifts or restaurant meals or leisure travel or liposuction or lap dancing or all of those pleasures, little pleasures in life that you might fork out some bucks for. But of course, you know, what is a necessity is a big question which doesn't have an easy answer, and we struggled with it through the whole year. And that was really part of the lesson we learned. What is a necessity, and how do you think about that question?
And you also gave up not just buying material items, but there were a lot of experiences that you chose not to pay for during this year.
That's right. We didn't go to restaurants. We didn't go to the theater. We didn't go to movies. And for me, that was really the hardest part of it. I didn't miss material things or, you know, products very much, but I really felt lonely when I couldn't go to a bar and have a drink with a friend or sit in a cafe and just read and watch the world go by. And I felt a little stupid when I wasn't able to talk about the movies that everybody else had seen. I'm a journalist, so I stake a lot of my identity on being in the know. And when you can't purchase things to know about, well, then you really fall behind.
And I think there's kind of a poignant scene in the book where you describe sitting there with the paper and cutting out restaurant reviews to save for the time
for
that your year was up.
Right. It's sort of like a historian, you know, reading the microfilm from, you know, from some other era that I wouldn't participate in.
Did your friends have a hard time sort of going along with this after they realized that it meant you wouldn't be going with them to bars and restaurants and concerts?
Well, at first, I said they regarded us with an attitude that there's probably some German word for, which means admiration for an enterprise you're glad somebody else is doing so that you don't have to. But as time wore on, I have to say there was a slight penalty for hanging out with Paul and Judith, and that was you weren't allowed to do anything. So, yeah, you could take a walk, or you could go have a picnic, or you could go to, you know, a poetry reading at the library. It was all a little square, you know. So while, yes, they did admire us, and some of them sort of tried to emulate our, you know, righteous behavior, I think it got a little bit tiresome for some of them.
What really strikes me about the things that have been written since the book originally came out, now it's out in a paperback version, is two things. One, how many people have emulated you, and the other is how many people have been all over you about what they perceive to be hypocritical exceptions that you made.
Right. Well, you know, I never really set out. I very much admire, for instance, Barbara Ehrenreich's book, where she went and she got a bunch of minimum wage jobs just to see if you could live on it. And her answer was, no, you cannot. So I never was really setting out to even, for one thing, set myself up as an example for others to follow, but to try to feel what people feel who cannot buy anything. I don't imagine that I could feel, could understand what that feels like. So yes, you know, people said, for instance, Paul and I met when we were 40 years old and we each lived in a different place, he in Vermont and I in New York, and so we continued to do that. We lived together some of the time and apart some of the time, and so we have two houses. It's an extraordinary luxury. I completely admit it. And so people said, how can she, you know, such a wealthy person, you know, even pretend to be going without. But I think that's a misunderstanding of what this project was about. We all in the United States consume quite a lot. Even poor people consume a lot compared to poor people in other parts of the world. And what I really tried to get at was how intertwined the consumer culture is with our everyday lives, with our feelings, with our relationships. And so, you know, I wasn't trying to prove myself to be superior to other people, but that was an interesting part of it because I think sometimes a lot of simple living is a way of expressing your superiority to other people. And I have to say it was hard while I was doing it not to be judgmental of all those greedy people out there, you know, buying their $20 martinis.
You know, one thing, Judith, that is fascinating to me throughout the book is the sense that it really gives of how much we all use buying, whatever choices we're making, to express ourselves. And I was amazed that for you, even as a writer who has plenty of opportunity to express herself, you sort of felt this as well.
Well, you know, the things we wear, the books we read, the places we hang out, all of these are ways of expressing who we are, how we affiliate with other people. You know, I'm a hipster, I'm a librarian. You know, especially in the city, when you walk down the street, you look at a person and you get to know a lot about them, or you think you do. And so, you know, consumption gives us this way, that's right, of expressing who we are. And when we stop doing it, I found that I reverted to an older expression, an older identity, and that was a bohemian, you know, somebody who was wearing two different pairs, two different socks because one of them had a hole in it. And to sort of proudly embrace that. But, you know, you can't not breathe the air, and the air that we live is a consuming air.
And it's interesting the time in your life that you chose to do this, because we sort of accept that bohemian lifestyle with someone who's in school or just out of school, but you were 50 years old when you did this.
That's right. And, you know, as a writer, I can say that I'm still something of a bohemian. I can't really, you know, afford to be much more than that. But, you know, I like to have a nice sofa in my house, you know, and I like to serve a nice meal to people. So I've become bourgeois, too. It's an interesting thing now because a lot of people, you know, executives who've had huge salaries are suddenly finding themselves on the unemployment line or working at a minimum wage job. And, you know, how are people going to, you know, readjust their sense of themselves? It's a very difficult thing in capitalism to feel good about yourself if you can't buy something. I had one experience where I went somewhere. I went to Washington for a protest march, and I came back, and, you know, I had decided I would take the bus, which was a grueling experience, and I got home at midnight, and then I was going to take the subway home, and I got down to the subway, and it pulled out of the station. I had to stand there for half an hour, and, you know, as a middle-class person, you ought to, like, hail a cab and get into it, and I had this feeling of sort of self-pity and smallness and powerlessness just because I had voluntarily put myself into this position of not being able to buy things.
Yeah, this idea, you found that you couldn't buy your way out of predicaments the way you might have in the past without giving it a second thought. You could afford to take a cab, so therefore you would have done so.
Right, and, you know, in New York City, for instance, the minute a drop of rain falls on the sidewalk, 2,000 people appear selling umbrellas. It's magic. And so everyone in New York City goes out and they fork over their $5 for a really bad umbrella, which breaks the first time you use it, but at least you don't get wet. But I wasn't doing that. Or I'd just be walking around and I'd be hungry or I'd be tired and be cold. I didn't go in and have a coffee. These are the small things that make life, I have to say, a lot more pleasant.
There was even an issue for you. You lost your favorite pair of socks.
I lost my favorite pair of socks, and I almost killed myself running around. And I lost my favorite pair of socks, which are socks that I use when I go cross-country skiing. Now, this is one of these, you know, cheap amusements that you can do by just walking out the door. And yet, I had gotten so attached to these Smart Wool socks that I imagined that they made me a better skier, that they made my skiing experience so much more enjoyable and comfortable and dry and wicked and everything else, that not being able to find the socks made me not want to go skiing. This is what Freud refers to as a fetish, mm-hmm. when the object replaces the pleasure of the thing that the object is supposed to make more fun.
And I think we've all done that, too, where if you lose something and you don't want to go through the trouble of finding it, on some occasions we'll say, well, I'll just go get another one and the other thing will turn up at some point.
That's right. And then you look in your closet and you find that you have five of whatever it was.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that certainly made our lives a lot easier. We never had to buy, you know, a bottle of shampoo because we had been collecting them up in every hotel we'd ever stayed in. And so we had, you know, thousands of little bottles. And I'm here to tell your listeners that they are all the same, buy the cheapest one.
Judith Levine is my guest. She's a journalist who spent a year without buying anything. Her book, which has just been re-released in paperback, is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Join us after the break by getting on the line now at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Judith Levine is my guest. Her book is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. If you want to join us, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. We should say that you did have, in 2004, a fair amount of debt, at least relative to your income. Was that something that had stressed you out before?
It was a constant sort of a hanging on feeling of anxiety and a kind of frustration that I just couldn't pay it down. And it was about $8,000. And I earned probably before taxes about $50,000 a year, between 40 and 50. So it was true. It was a lot. At that point, it was about the average debt for an American household, credit card debt. And simply by not buying things, and we weren't looking for the cheapest things when we did buy things, I paid that down in 2004, and I haven't run it up again.
Now, obviously, your friends and people that were sort of in your circle knew what you were doing, but I wonder how often you found yourself having to explain this to strangers to sort of justify why you weren't making a purchase in particular situations.
Well, that was one of these kind of journalistic decisions that I tried to make, which was, one friend said to me, you know, if you dress in rags and look like you're homeless, and people will treat you like you're homeless, and you may learn as a journalist something about what that feels like. If you tell everyone that you're dressed like this because you're trying to find out what it is to be homeless, they'll treat you like a journalist who looks like a homeless person. Mm-hmm. And so I tried not to tell people what I was doing. I just didn't buy it. And so while our close friends knew what we were doing, you know, ordinary people, for instance, one day I went skiing at a place near us and I didn't have any wax, so I had forgotten to put wax on. And if anyone knows about cross-country skiing, it doesn't work without the wax. So I just had to ask a guy, would he lend me some wax? You know, we're talking about a penny's worth of wax. But it put me in a position of having to ask for help pretty often. And that's, as you said before, you can buy your way out of predicaments. You don't have to ask for help, which means you don't have to talk to people. You don't have to, you know, put yourself in a vulnerable position. And one of the nice things about this experience was that I found that people really do like to help each other, and they appreciate being given small opportunities to do so. Now, of course, they don't want to take care of you, and so you're always trying to walk this line between not being a sort of freeloader and just, you know, showing up for dinner when it happens to be showing up at somebody's door when dinner is being put on the table, and just doing the kind of ordinary human thing of asking for help and then thinking of ways to reciprocate without buying.
It's a fascinating, really double-edged sword, I think, in American culture. As Americans, we pride ourselves on self-reliance, and as opposed to a sort of communal culture where we not only help other people, but expect that they'll help us.
That's true. The book that I wrote before this was a memoir of my father who had Alzheimer's, and one of the things that I learned from that and writing about that was that one of the reasons that we're so worried about dementia in our culture is because we really value, and I would say overvalue, autonomy, and people worry about not being a burden to their children or their children not being a burden to them, you know. So in cultures that don't worry about that much, they don't worry so much about frailty, about aging, about vulnerability, about disability, about poverty. I mean, these are all ways in which we need one another, and putting yourself in the position of vulnerability, I think, may give you some more compassion for people who are vulnerable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Talking this hour to Judith Levine. Her book is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Let's speak to Molly in Hearst. Hello, Molly.
Yes, I would like to say that I really, with the dearth of books that are written about making sacrifices for a year or such thing, that this is, I certainly like this angle better. It's not just, you know, it only eating organic food or something like that, because that it is exactly the opposite. The people in this position can't afford to do such things. And that I love that she appreciates that there are so many people who just live like this. I was raised working class, and I was always friends with people who were sort of middle class, and they never understood that you just couldn't buy these things and couldn't do these things. And I'm still in that situation of being this minimum wage worker who can't do these things and can't, you know, have the little things that she's talking about. And that the spiral of that, how it can just keep going, is disturbing. And with the new economic downturns, I keep hearing more and more people who are going, oh, it's so terrible, I had to give up this and give up that. It's like, well, some of us just always lived like this. And I hope that it does improve the way that people learn to help one another out, that this is and needs to be a more interdependent society. And I wondered if she could possibly elaborate a bit more on some of the positives that she learned from it, because I think that we could all stand to hear a little bit of that at this point.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you, Molly. You know, I think for me, the big lesson that I learned is not just about what you're talking about or what I was just talking about before, which is that personally we need to help one another and we need to recognize, you know, each other's circumstances. But that we get to make decisions not just personally, but as a community, as a society, as a nation. We have a certain number of dollars in our pockets, and we can divide that up between personal consumption for just ourselves and our families, and frankly, paying taxes to fund the things that help everyone, not just the poor, not just the rich, but everyone. And one of the things that Paul and I really noticed during that year was we were thrown for our amusement and our stimulation onto the public sphere. We went to the public library, we went to the public parks, and we were very grateful for these things, and we saw that they were in very bad condition, shabby. And we saw that, you know, it really recommitted me to making sure that these things are really taken care of, because it's not just for those people, the poor people who can't afford their own, it's for everybody. And there are rewards beyond just the thing, and that is a sense of community, a sense of being in it together. If you have a municipal swimming pool that you all pay for, you bring your kids there, your kids see your friends, they maybe get, you know, free or cheap swimming lessons, and you can go do something else instead of having to buy your own swimming pool, you know, or you know, mooch on your neighbors to swim in theirs. And so the sense that we care for each other, that we get rewarded by caring for each other, I think is actually, you know, one of the things that got Barack Obama elected this time, and I'm really relieved about it.
I think you walked the line really well in the book, but there could have been a danger of sort of romanticizing poverty. You know, Molly talked about, you know, sort of trying to keep body and soul together on a minimum wage income, and it is not easy. And there are a lot of people who are, whether willingly or not, thrown into this situation right now. Was that a concern as you went into the project that you didn't want to sort of only talk about what was so great about this and what you gained, because there are people who don't have a choice?
Absolutely. You know, there's one of the things I investigated was the simple living movement, and I think there are a lot of great things about the simple living, you know, voluntary simplicity people. But, you know, one of the claims is that if you declutter your house and if you have nothing, you will discover your authentic self and your soul will be, you know, elevated. And I just recently wrote a piece called Against Thrift, because it's the same idea that hardship is good for the soul. And I think that this is not only condescending to people who have real hardship, but it's just, for me, not a particularly good motivation for a social movement to feel guilty, to feel ashamed, to feel that you've been bad and now you should flagellate yourself and punish yourself by not having, especially because, as you say, most people in the world, most people are under-consuming. They don't have enough. And so, you know, we really have to understand the role of consumption, you know, not just in terms of pleasure, but in terms of people's necessities. And as you say, not to idealize or romanticize poverty. There's a difference between making a choice to buy less and being put in a position because you don't have, you know, a good enough wage, or you've been sick and you've used all your money on health care, to not have anything.
We have an email from Jackie to think@kera.org. She writes, as someone who uses retail therapy on occasion, I'm intrigued at the idea of anyone going a year without buying anything. I'd like to know what were the first things you bought when the year was up, how you felt about buying again, and how your habits are different now.
I didn't come out of the year with a long list of things that I wanted to buy. One of the things I recognized about shopping, it is often an impulse, you know, and impulses pass. So I only went out on January 1st, and I rented 6 movies and just watched them all up in a binge. And my partner went out and bought some Q-tips because he had been yearning.
He was dying without the Q. Well, you both sort of were.
Yeah, I felt, you know, more stoic about it, I guess. But I came out of it, both of us, really having pretty much defeated impulse shopping. And just knowing that if you wait a couple of minutes, you probably won't need the thing or want the thing anymore. We don't go to restaurants unless it's a restaurant that we are really interested in going to. We don't just go there, you know, to, as Paul says, to fill a meal slot. And I do think that we have both become much more conscious of the things that we buy, and for me, much more appreciative of all the things that I have, really feeling like I have plenty more than enough. And I think another thing that has changed for me is that I give away a lot more money. I don't make more, but I did definitely give more.
It was an issue for you. You said you decided not to buy any gifts that year, but your niece, to whom you were very close, was graduating, and you were sort of in a quandary about what to do for that.
That's right. You know, graduating from college is a pretty big accomplishment, and you want to give somebody a pretty big gift. So we thought about it for a long time, and we had various crafts on our mind that we might do, and it seemed quite right. And then finally, as the day approached, we came upon giving her something that already belonged to me, and that was a silver and turquoise necklace that my mother had bought during World War II and had given me, and it was sitting around. And so I polished it up, and Paul fixed the clasp on it, and we gave it to Sarah. And when she put it on, she said, "Now I always have something of Grandma and Judy with me." And she's a girl who really loves her family, and it was so much more meaningful a present than anything we could have bought her. And furthermore, it was really nice to think a lot about it instead of just going out and getting her some luggage or something and thinking of it as sort of an obligation or a chore, but to really think about her and what she might like and, you know, putting our imagination to use, and it definitely worked.
Have your social relationships with your friends sort of gone back to where they were? You mentioned that you only go to restaurants when you really want to be there. Do you still sort of hang out and take walks with people, or is that one of the things that went by the wayside?
No, we still do. And Paul and I are lucky to live half the time in rural Vermont and half the time in Brooklyn, New York. So in rural Vermont, that's mainly what you do. You go for a walk or you invite somebody to dinner. So we continue to do that. And I always loved doing that, and I think that my friends started to maybe appreciate it even more.
What did you discover about the way, and you mentioned this earlier, you alluded to the fact that you were irritated by people making stupid purchases around you. Were you more sharply focused on everybody else's buying?
In one way, I was, in that judgmental way, but in another way, I found myself sort of really falling out of the world of consumption. For instance, I didn't look at advertisements at all. They just almost disappeared from view. I treated stores kind of as museums where you would look in the vitrine of the window and think, gee, that's an interesting object, just as you might view a painting in a museum that you don't have to own. But I did see, especially in New York, the really extravagant consumption that goes on, and this was before the crash. So, you know, 2004 was a pretty high year for people sitting out on the sidewalk and consuming extremely expensive meals. And you know, just removing yourself from that activity, I think necessarily makes you think, well, it made me think anyway, bigger than my own little private world. And, you know, you really start to think about everybody else in the world and, you know, what are they living on? You know, a huge number of people in this world live on $1 a day. You know, that's on one hand really tragic and really a crime. And you also think, like, they must know something that I don't know, you know, that maybe we could learn something from those people.
Is your level of happiness or satisfaction with your life, did you become more happy when you weren't buying anything, or did you find that that really wasn't related necessarily?
I am skeptical of the idea that it may be true that money does not buy happiness, but not spending money doesn't necessarily make you happier. In fact, I think what happens is it's more like this. When you use shopping as a way to assuage or avoid certain feelings of or cure certain feelings of anxiety or boredom, you don't ever have to face those feelings. And so not buying is a kind of meditation where you're sitting there and you just have to face the things and get to the other side of the feeling. So it means you sometimes have to experience that feeling first. So there's a certain amount of discomfort that it brings on, and yet it makes you recognize that you will get through them and it's okay, and it relieves a kind of anxiety in the long run, I think. But I wouldn't call it greater happiness necessarily.
You did, of all things, buy a pair of pants during this year. Can you talk about what that experience felt like when you had been so removed from retail completely?
Well, I happened to find myself, who knows how I got there, inside of a lovely shop in Burlington, Vermont. And there was this quite attractive salesperson with glasses, something like my glasses, and a style that I really liked. And we sort of talked to each other, and I looked around this store that seemed to be, whose merchandise seemed to be made just for me. And there was a little seduction that went on between the salesperson and me and the clothing. And I put on the clothes, and she said it looked so good on me, and I felt really pretty. And all of these very, very pleasurable interactions, which are part of the experience of shopping, if you don't do it all the time, came back to me. And I felt guilty. I felt like I was breaking my rule. I felt like I shouldn't do it. But I also felt a little, you know, they talk about guilty pleasures. I felt a little, you know, naughty in a good way that I was purchasing this thing. And so, you know, there's a lot of mixed feelings around it.
Journalist Judith Levine is my guest. Her book is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. We'll resume our conversation after the break, and you are welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Judith Levine is my guest. Her latest book has just been re-released in paperback. It's called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Tammy. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
It's a very fascinating subject. I really appreciate that Judith has tried this experiment of just doing without for a little while. I wanted to just speak about my experience as a live-in nanny in Aspen, Colorado, and what I perceive to be this climate of extravagance, especially from my perspective living in a household where there was a lot of consumption, a lot of material wealth, and also stress, something I never really had thought might exist in such households. The stress of maintaining status, the stress of having to manage all the stuff in the home. Also had to deal with some judgmentalism in terms of, one example is one day we were making what I thought was just potato soup, but apparently was going to be vichyssoise, and because I chose to eat it before it had gone to the food, the blender, what I ate was called peasant soup, and they were laughing at me for eating it before it became vichyssoise, which is basically just pureed potato soup. And so there was this sense of everything being labeled, and, you know, something was déclassé if it wasn't, you know, just up to status. And then I also noticed that children didn't have a hands-on connection with their parents because that was considered déclassé. And so I'm wondering if Judith can comment about the children that she might have had a chance to interact with in doing research for this, and if she had any, I guess, exposure to youth doing presentations about this book and how that is impacting youth in terms of considering where they want to be as adults and materially what they want to consume and how much.
Thanks for your call, Tammy, and keep eating potato soup. It's good for you.
Thanks.
Thank you for your comments, Tammy. I think those are very deep and complicated questions. I don't know whether wealthier people are less or more, you know, connected with their children. It certainly helps to have time, you know, if you want to be connected with your kids. And sometimes people who don't have a job have more time, and some people who have a lot of money have more time. And so, and it also has to do with what your society gives you. I was in Amsterdam some years ago and just noticed that because everybody gets off work at 5 o'clock, they're all out in the park with their kids on their bicycles. So that's a society that values children and so values, you know, attention to children. So, but I have gotten quite a lot of mail from young adults and even high school kids who are thinking about these issues, and, you know, maybe because they're growing up in a less economically secure time than, say, I grew up in the 50s, they are going to have to make choices, you know, about their educations, about the work that they're going to do. These are not going to be all good choices. They're not going to, some of them will be compelled choices. But they may also, as you're suggesting, find other rewards at working at things that don't necessarily make you lots of money. I mean, I've been struck by articles lately about what's happening to dating relationships between people who have worked in the financial industries and made tons and tons of money in their 20s, you know, and their girlfriends and boyfriends who now are not quite so impressed by them. So their sense of their sexual prowess or their just ability to be impressive was so much buttressed by the amount of money that they were making that now those young people will have to find something else in themselves, you know, to feel good about and to express. So, you know, again, I don't think that, I don't wish economic hardship on anybody, but it is true that, you know, you have to learn to value yourself and value other people in ways that don't have to do with money.
Do you think that those two things are related, that sense of importance and self-worth as is related to one's income? Is that related to the kind of snobbery that Tammy was talking about?
Yes, certainly. You know, in America, one of the things that some sociologists talk about now, like Robert Franks, who's an economist, that he used to just have to keep up with the Joneses who lived in your neighborhood. So they were probably economically, socially about at the same level as you and your family. But now we watch television and we see that, you know, Richard Gere is building a replica of a Medici chapel in his backyard. You know, I think I'd like one of those too, you know. So we really have to keep up with somebody who's like way, way, way out of our reach economically. And so, you know, you can always feel like you're not quite measuring up, you know. And so it throws us back on ourselves to try to keep on remembering what it was that we care about. But, you know, I think this is a problem that plagues everyone, artists, writers. You know, if I'm not making a lot of money, what's wrong with me? You know, there's so much self-worth that is connected, that's measured out by the amount of money you make. I think it's very, very hard to, you know, to avoid, to escape that.
Did this change your relationship with Paul?
It was a very, very sweet year for us, partly because we just had so much time hanging around together. you know, he felt it was, he talked about reconnecting with the ordinary, which is something that he likes quite a lot. And we spent a lot of time not just, you know, talking to each other, cooking together, playing Scrabble, taking walks, and, you know, just being together. And it's also fun to have a project to do with somebody that you love.
Are there things that you miss beyond maybe that togetherness about your no-buy year?
You know, there's a way that I think that consumption can scatter you. I sometimes feel that way now that, you know, you sit down and you go online to buy some printer thing, and then, you know, 3 hours later you look up having saved $5 by doing all this consumption.
consumer research. And so there's a kind of focus, and I guess it is simplicity, that we achieved during that year that was very calming.
Do you have the sense that there are things that you will never buy again?
I don't know about what I will never buy again. I can tell you what I will never live without again.
Okay. Short list, maybe.
Ice cream.
Oh, that was a big deal for you.
It was. You know, you learn what you can live without and what you can... Well, one thing we have never gone back to buying is Kleenexes in a box. We started to use toilet paper, and we still do. So it's a little funky having it sitting on your bed table, but...
It is the same thing.
It, you know, 3 years later, 4 years later. But I do, you know, certain things like ice cream, but also certain things like we started to go to the theater more after that year because I recognize it's something that just really makes me think a lot and feel a lot and learn a lot and be connected to the culture that I live in. And I live in New York City, and why not? And so that's something that we spend money on, but we don't spend money on something else so that we can do that. So, you know, you get to make choices like that if you are lucky enough to have, you know, a sufficient income like I do. And then sometimes I don't have a sufficient income. And so the other part of this experience was it really calmed me down about the future. I recognize that now that I've lost 40% of my savings too, that I can live on very little and live happily. And so this idea that you have to have $1.7 million or something like that to live, you know, when you're old, I know I don't have to. And that just makes me feel more secure about my future and happier about being able to do the things that I care about now.
Yeah, that's really interesting because that sort of anxiety seems to be just ruining every experience right now, even for people who are, at the face of it, okay at this moment.
That's true that, you know, people are really scared that tomorrow it's going to be all over. And I do think that there's been just a great escalation and an exaggeration of our needs over these quite wealthy few years, or at least there was an illusion that we were wealthy, or some of us were wealthy. And so people started to think, gosh, I really need a lot to be happy, to be secure. But I do think we have to get to work as a society, making sure that certain kinds of security, such as social security and healthcare security will be provided, that we will make sure to invest in that, because that's what's really going to impoverish you. But, you know, I think we may go back to realizing, you know what, you could be fine without, you know, living in a big house or owning two cars.
Well, and you mentioned earlier not that you spent that year really not reading ads, and certain kinds of magazines and media really make you think you need things.
That's true, and those magazines and media are not doing very well right now. A lot of them are, you know, are just collapsing. All of these fancy architecture magazines. I just read the other day that Gourmet magazine or these other food magazines are starting to give people ideas of good home cooking that doesn't cost very much. And, you know, anybody who's ever eaten Italian food knows that it's pretty simple, pretty cheap, and pretty good. So, you know, we will, I think, learn to readjust, and maybe there'll be a kind of, you know, deflation of this great exaggeration of our so-called needs.
Can you imagine any scenario in which you would do this again?
I know that there will be scenarios in which I am going to again. As a writer, my income comes and my income goes, and you know this recession is really hitting my industry very much, like your industry. I know that I can. I talked about at one point in the book about people who have jobs who are sort of on these big Titanics, and when they fall off them, they can't do anything. And here, Paul and me were both freelancers, you know, navigating our little kayaks around. And so, you know, you learn to travel light.
Would you amend the rules that you created for yourself?
I don't think so. You know, now thinking about sort of sensible consumption. I have introduced, for instance, I do buy books. I always buy books. You know, I feel a responsibility to the book industry, but I also think that that's just an important thing to spend money on. And I guess, you know, these are my own priorities. I would like our culture our nation to have a priority to spend money on the arts, for instance. These are things that don't seem to be perfectly practical, and yet I think they enhance our lives immensely and make us better people and happier. So that's another thing I learned is that, you know, it's not just the practical things that are necessary. Beauty is necessary. You know, pleasure is necessary. Communion is necessary. Ecstasy is necessary. And that goes back to the first question you asked me. Capitalism gives us everything except what we really need. And those are things that, the things that are really free, you know, and those are things that are necessary too. Consumption can sometimes aid in them. And so, you know, we just have to figure out the balance of how much to buy, how much to throw out, how much to care about our earth, because a lot of consumption is messing it up. You know, and how can we spend our money wisely, share it, do what's best for us all.
Well, you mentioned earlier that, that despite the fact that your income is certainly no higher than it was before, that you're trying to give more of it away. Where are you focusing your giving now?
I have always tended to be to try to give money to things that are going to change the world, not just to put Band-Aids on it. So I like to give money to political organizations. I give money to stuff that helps prisoners and gets rid of prisons. I care about reproductive rights, and I give money to that. I give some money to youth organizations, but I like to try to give money to people who are trying to, you know, figure out different ways of doing things.
Is this experience something that you would recommend to other people?
I think it's an instructive, growing experience. I don't hold myself out as some sort of, you know, paragon of righteousness. And you know, people have, it's harder to do if you have kids who are nagging you. You know, it's harder to do if you have, you know, if I lived in Los Angeles and had to drive 40 miles to work, well, I wouldn't have the luxury of, you know, not having a good car, for instance. So, but yeah, I think you can learn something by just stopping any kind of, any kind of habitual behavior teaches you something.
Have you been interested to follow, I don't know if you've paid much attention to everyone who quotes your book and then writes their own article or piece about trying to do the same thing?
Yes, you know, everyone writes to me and says I'm doing it too. And I have to say it's a kind of primate-like monkey-like behavior. You know, I want people to get all the subtle messages, and there they are just, you know, trying slavishly to do the same. If it's a way of, you know, of saving some money, a way of thinking about your consumption, that's great. But, you know, I don't think that abstinence works as a general rule. You know, dieting, if you want to learn, if you want to lose weight, get some exercise and, you know, start to eat more moderately. Don't stop eating all food.
Judith Levine is a freelance journalist. Her book, now out in paperback, is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Judith, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.